Hey everybody, if you want to tell the world something or sell the world something, head on over to Squarespace because they're going to help you build the website of your dreams. Say you want to sell some custom merch. Well, you can set up your online store. Whether you sell physical, digital, or service products, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online. So go to squarespace.com/stuff right now and you will face a free trial. And when you get ready to launch, use our offer code STUFF and then you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. How could you go wrong with Squarespace?
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh, and there's Chuck, and Jerry's here, too. And this is Stuff You Should Know, the Brainiac Edition.
That's right. I was trying to think of something, and I was truly blank.
That's very appropriate. Totally, Chuck. Because we are talking today about human intelligence and the origin of human intelligence, and it just seems super Stuff You Should Know-y for us to not be able to come up with a decent joke. You know?
Well, Ed did that for us, actually, because I did want to shout out, we usually don't mention like section titles and stuff like that that's actually in our notes. But Ed dropped, because it's, you know, it's for our eyes, but Ed dropped a Simpsons reference.
Oh, yeah.
In his section title, one of the great Simpsons references, Chimpan A to Chimpan Z. This was so great.
That was from the Planet of the Apes musical, right?
That's right. And I just, I like to think of that as a little gift from Ed to us.
Yeah, it definitely was. And it was well received too. So thanks, Ed. And the reason Ed created a section called Chimpanzee to Chimpanzee is because we're going to talk about the lineage of humanity, like where humans came from. And despite that hilarious and clever section title, we did not actually evolve from chimpanzees, but we do share a common ancestor from chimpanzees. So chimps and humans split off from a shared ancestor about 6 to 8 million years ago. And that really kicked off a long line, very long process of evolution where intelligence started to develop fairly early on. It just was really slow to start. And then over time, it kind of picked up speed.
Yeah, you found this kind of cool statistic. There's a researcher, writer named Richard Leakey. And Richard, and I think most people agree, they posit that there was what's called a big bang of human culture around the upper Paleolithic time period where things were, like you said, slow going for so long, and things were measured in eras before that very, very slowly over like hundreds of millennia. And then all of a sudden, like 60 to 30,000 years ago or so, things started to really ramp up in terms of innovation and intelligence and just really moving the ball forward, to use a football metaphor.
Sure.
And we're talking about, you know, clothing and social structure and art and creativity and stuff like that. So it's kind of cool to think, and, you know, we're going to talk about why that might have happened, but the fact that that did happen got us on the moon in short order over the last few thousand years.
Yeah, it's kind of like if you look at the development of intelligence as a train that's starting from a stop, it starts out with kind of a chug, a chug, a chug, a chug, a chug, a chug, a chug. And then that upper Paleolithic revolution, the big bang of culture, that's the choo-choo part that really punctuates the whole thing.
I was thinking more along the lines of like a Japanese bullet train, but sure.
I don't think we're there quite yet.
Okay.
We still do some really stupid stuff, so
I wouldn't say. But we can also create a bullet train.
We can, but we just can't be the bullet train intellectually.
Oh, man. Mind blown.
So, Chuck, the fact that 30 to 60,000 years ago, there was that Upper Paleolithic Revolution where humanity just suddenly blossomed into what we recognize today as humanity, it's really tempting to think that human intelligence just was suddenly born all of a sudden, like geologically speaking, overnight at that time. But that's just not the case. It seems like something definitely happened there, like some wire connected with another wire that mm-hmm. really made a big difference. But instead, again, it was this part of this very long line of seemingly random and unconnected developments in the history of humanity and I guess our genus Homo that led to that point and actually led to that point today because we're still evolving and developing.
Yeah, I guess if you look at it on a timeline, though, it looks like a mechanic came along and said, "Well, here's your problem. You forgot to plug it in."
That's right. That's right.
You got to plug these two wires together, and then you're all set.
Yeah, totally.
But we like to talk about Homo sapiens in terms of human intelligence for good reason. Homo sapiens, that is to say us, mm-hmm. aka modern humans, mm-hmm. evolved about 300,000 years ago. But we are just one of a collection of in this big lovely family called the homonyms.
Yeah.
And hominins.
Hominins, yeah.
I think it said M's.
Yeah. So the hominins are everybody that started off branching from that common ancestor with chimps. That's the hominin line. And humans in our genus Homo, that Homo sapiens are a part of, is just part of that hominin. There are other entirely different genus or genii that make up the hominin line, right?
That's right. And we should point out that sapiens actually is taken from the Latin word for knowledge. So mm-hmm. it kind of all makes sense.
It does. So the whole thing starts out, it seems like, as far back as we can tell, something, again, like somewhere around 6 or so million years ago, there was a group of homonyms called Ardipithecus who basically walked upright, but that was essentially the big difference between them and chimpanzees. But as we'll see, that was a really, really big difference, right?
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into this in more detail, but obviously if you're walking upright, then you have a very important thing at your disposal, which is use of your hands.
Right. So then you got Australopithecus and a few other different kinds of branches that kind of branch off. It's a really tangled, convoluted family tree where some kind of led to blind alleys, others lead to others, but they think that Australopithecus was a really big, long-lasting group that was a little more human, definitely more human than Ardipithecus, but not quite as human as the genus Homo, which kicked off all of these different species of human. Because we're alive today, we're on, you know, planet Earth, living here in 2022, and every single human alive is a member of the same species. So, like, there's different kinds of cats. There's different kinds of fish species. There's different kinds of bird species. There's only one kind of human species, but that wasn't always the case. There were plenty of different human species, some living alongside one another for tens or hundreds of thousands of years.
That's right. And almost all the hominins use tools, it seems like, and made tools. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, we thought that was sort of it, that only the Homo genus was the one who did use tools, which is, and, you know, we talk about things like being bipedal and using tools as sort of some of the building blocks of what would become human intelligence.
Right.
But now we know that there are some older, you know, we found evidence that they used tools before that. And that's kind of fairly recently, right?
Yeah. We wanted to say that tool making started sometime after the Homo genus showed up a couple million years ago. But we found even older tools. So it seems like Australopithecus, which again, they're hominins. They're part of the branch that led to us humans, but they're not human in any way, shape, or form. So the fact that they're using tools was kind of mind-blowing. And it also really kind of undermined kind of like what you were saying, like our idea of using tools, like that's a big sign of intelligence and humans are intelligent. So it's weird to find out that non-humans were using tools millions mm-hmm. of years ago.
That's right. should we move on to the hardware software thing?
Yeah. So if tools and fire are not, because we found use of fire dating back at least a million years. So if tools, fire, hanging out with one another collectively, if these aren't like the indicators that make human intelligence, we've got to like get a little more granular. And fortunately for you and I sitting here today, Chuck, scientists have done that and they've come up with some really interesting like ways of looking at this.
Yeah, and as a bit more of a preamble before we get actually to the intelligence, and I like the way Ed put this, sort of like talking about hardware versus software. Mm-hmm. They were very intertwined and, you know, sort of happening at the same time. So it's not like one couldn't happen without the other as far as the hardware-software thing goes. But right. If we're looking at hardware and we're talking about changes that made us like better at walking upright, like you all of a sudden just don't stand up and start walking. Like this happens over a long, long period of time. Our hind legs got longer. The shape of our pelvis changed. There's something called the foramen magnum, which is a hole in the base of the skull where the spinal cord and lots of nerves and things pass to like sort of open up those neural pathways. Mm-hmm. And that changed its location. So these literal physical changes are happening over great periods of time in order just to be able to walk upright.
Right. And bipedalism, it's like the defining characteristic of hominins, right? There's not really, as far as I can tell, any other animals that walk upright like by default.
Right.
So there had to be physiological changes. But they're not entirely certain why we started walking upright. But the fact that we did, and it's lasted for this long, means that there was some advantage to it because enough people walking upright were able to pass along their genes. And they think one big theory is that it helped us survive climate change, where maybe things got colder and there were less trees. So since we weren't arboreal anymore, we didn't hang out and live and eat in trees, we were able to kind of move around and find different like food sources and different shelters, whereas the like our cousins, the chimps, were in big trouble. They were up the proverbial creek.
Yeah, and I love that you point out that we're the only ones who walk upright by default, because I think we can all agree there's nothing more fun than YouTube videos of like a dog or a cat or something just walking on its hind legs for some reason.
Definitely. And
it's the coolest and most fun thing ever.
It totally is. And I mean, I'll take like a Jesus lizard running across some water once in a while too. There's nothing wrong with watching that.
Is that what those are called?
Yeah.
I think I saw one of those in Mexico.
But that was surprising.
Are they not there?
I don't know. I'm just saying I've never seen one in real life, so I'm sure that was surprising to see.
I saw a lizard that was walking.
Huh.
And it wasn't walking on water, but I think it was one of those kinds that can. I just didn't know the name of it.
Had you recently eaten the worm from the bottom of a bottle of mezcal?
Very funny. Another thing we should point out is that walking upright is an energy saver. I mean, mm-hmm. They've done studies and they found that you use about 25% of the energy rather than, you know, bounding around on all fours like a chimp might.
Right.
Or like a chimp does.
But to save that energy, to conserve it, our pelvises had to change shape, like you mentioned. That was just a consequence of walking upright. And the reason it changed shape is when you walk upright, if you're a chimp, your body swings side to side. You have to hold your arms up to balance yourself. That takes a lot of energy. So we developed like gluteal muscles and other muscles that can cling to a specific shaped and sized pelvis so that we don't have to spend all that energy. Our muscles are just kind of keeping us much more balanced. But one of the consequences of that, of walking upright and our pelvis changing, means that the size of the birth canal afforded by the hole in the pelvis that a child passes through during birth got smaller, a lot smaller. And it's really strange to think that the decreasing in size of the birth canal actually was one of the factors that led to an increase in intelligence.
Yeah, and you know, we should point out, this is just the first of what will be a lovely cascade of theories that we're going to lay on your brains today. And that, like you said earlier, there is no one single one. It's kind of, when you put all of this stuff together, I think that's sort of the beauty of human intelligence, mm-hmm. is it took all of these great things sort of coalescing. But the whole thing with the brain is interesting because the size of the brain is one of nature's kind of controversies. Like, we know that as far as humans go, just because you have a bigger brain doesn't mean that you definitely will be smarter.
Right.
But there are some correlations across species in nature, and in humans. There can be, you know, evidence that a bigger brain means you're more intelligent, but it's not one of those things where it's settled science where they just say, hey, if you got a bigger brain, you're going to be smarter.
No. And in fact, like, there's all sorts of evidence in nature that suggests that's not the case, because our brain to body size ratio among humans is 1 to 40. So our brain makes up about 1/40th of our body mass. And that's the same ratio that a mouse has. Mice just, I don't care how you cut it, they're just not as intelligent as humans. But on the other hand, an elephant's brain to body ratio is 1 to 560, and elephants are super smart.
Right.
So you can't really find much there that says, you know, there's no direct correlation where it's like the bigger the brain, the more intelligent the being. But there does have to be some minimum amount of brain size, because it seems like the connections of the brain, as we'll see, are what really matter. And the more brain tissue you have up to a certain point, the more connections that can be made.
Right. So that brings us back to the birth canal situation. Like you mentioned, you're walking upright. It changes the shape of the pelvis. You have a much smaller birth canal all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. So evolutionarily speaking, you might think, well, does that mean we're going to have babies with tiny, tiny little heads and therefore tiny, tiny little brains that may not be able to grow very fast because it's enclosed in a skull that's sort of locked down?
Right.
But that didn't happen to us. What happened was we have fontanelles, and we have this delayed fusing of the skull kind of, you know, closing for good. And so it allows, and it's, you know, it's remarkable still to think about this to me, but it allows that little baby head to squish down to get through the birth canal and get through the vagina and out into the world and stay that way for a while. And it's during that for a while period before that skull completely fuses that a human brain really, really grows a lot. And chimps don't have that ability.
No, a chimp, their skull fuses mostly in the womb, and their brain, as a consequence, grows mostly to what size it's going to reach in the womb. So on the one hand, a chimp baby, you could say, is much smarter and much less helpless than a human baby.
Oh, for sure.
But given enough time, the human baby's going to start to exceed the chimp's abilities very quickly. And it's because our development is delayed. We do a lot of developing outside of the womb, and that's afforded by that skull that's not fused for a couple years after birth. And this was not... There is no intelligent design, so this was not like a good solution or workaround. This was just a naturally selected trait, the skull not fusing, that was a solution to the smaller birth canal, not to increase intelligence, but the advent of babies being born that didn't have fused skulls allowed for the advent of intelligence.
Yeah, a solution to the problem of walking upright, which is really interesting to think about.
Yeah, and it also just goes to show, like, it's like nature is not always like elegantly simple. Sometimes it's really convoluted, and organisms, including us, are held together by like duct tape and bubble gum.
Right.
You know? And that's a good example of it.
I think that's a good time for the break. Yay.
Yay.
And we'll come back and drop some plasticity on your brain right after this.
Hey, everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website. Whether it's an online course or custom merch, Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next-generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace. Hey there, are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals. But you can drink water as clean as nature intended.
Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain, everybody. This rain is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants commonly found in groundwater.
Yep, Richard's Rainwater is naturally pure with no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing.
And you can enjoy the clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold-pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And we even have a special offer, don't we, Josh?
Yeah, text STUFF to 2512928887, and you'll get $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater. Sip the sky. Hey everybody, we're here to tell you about Viator, a tool that you can use to plan and book travel experiences around the world.
That's right. The Viator app and website make it easy to explore 300,000 plus travel experiences so you can discover what's out there no matter where you're traveling or what you're interested in.
Yep, Viator can help you plan better travel experiences. 300,000 plus travel experiences to choose from means you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy.
That's right. You can also enjoy real traveler reviews to get insider information from people who've already been on the experience that you're considering. Plus, you get free cancellation that helps you plan for the unexpected.
Yeah, and Viator offers 24/7 customer service, so you know you'll get support at any hour if things aren't going as planned. So download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
So Chuck, this is the point we're about to talk about brain plasticity. This seems to be what, if anything, explains human intelligence, and certainly the burst of intelligence that happened 30 to 60,000 years ago.
Yeah, and I think the opening statement to this whole thing is all you got to do is look at the fact that we learn almost everything as humans. Like from the moment we're born, there is some maybe instinctive knowledge, but like you said, like human babies are kind of helpless little dum-dums. Mm-hmm. And from that point forward, our brains are learning, and they're growing, and they're capable of learning, and they're capable of adapting. And this all has to do with plasticity.
Right. So just if you aren't familiar, plasticity is the brain's ability to basically rewire and create new connections as new experiences come along. And you can even take old experiences that you experience more than once, and the second and third and fourth time, those neural connections are going to become more sophisticated and more connected than they were before. So our brains are plastic. They can be molded and shaped, kind of like in the rhinoplasty sense of the word. They're not made of plastic. They can be molded, and they're molded by the connections that they make. So it's not necessarily that you have a giant brain. It's that you, human being, have a brain that is really highly capable of creating new connections, and it's those connections that forms the basis of intellect.
Yeah, and that really frees up, like, once you have a brain that's plastic and that can evolve, you know, to figure out a problem rather than taking eons and eons to have, like, genetically adapt to a solution to a problem.
Right.
If all of a sudden you have a brain that can figure something out, you do it so much quicker, and that frees you up to do more and learn more. And it creates this feedback loop all of a sudden where the process really, really speeds up. And that's, you know, basically what we saw 30 to 60,000 years ago.
Yeah. And the reason, and we're still seeing it today, Chuck. I mean, like, you know, 30 to 60,000 years ago, it was a huge burst of creativity and intelligence. But we're still talking about changes that took place over thousands of years. Now we're seeing changes to the human condition in our society that take place over like tens of years. So yeah. It still seems to be speeding up, and we're still going through the same process. But the I guess the best way to think about what you've just described is evolution, which typically, you know, forces changes on us based on environmental conditions, goes into the brain. Mm-hmm. And now it's the brain that's able to change. And like you said, it changes much faster. And that leaves genetic evolution or genetic natural selection to focus on selecting for traits that create more and more intelligence. So it creates that positive feedback loop, like you said, and speeds things up. It's pretty brilliant.
So there's been a lot of really interesting research, especially in the, it seemed like the early to mid 1990s about plasticity. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of researchers named Tubi and Cosmides, great names. And they had a theory basically that human intelligence evolved with all these encapsulated cognitive models. So they did not have the ability to access each other, each of these modules.
Right.
And each one was very specialized for a very specialized problem or task that it was trying to do or problem that it was trying to solve. And that's like a language module, a spatial relation module. Here's how to make and use a tool, that kind of a module.
Right.
And that all these modules are still around. In basically the same form that they were back then, because they're on the timeline of, you know, humanity, that hasn't been a lot of time to undergo any kind of modifications, basically.
So I disagree with that. I think speaking about classic evolution, natural selection, that's true. But brain-based evolution and natural selection, like cultural natural selection, I think that that's false.
You hear that, Tubi?
So the idea about all this is that these modules that we developed over time is like we came upon new problems in our environments and had to figure out new solutions to them. They started to kind of get cross-referenced here or there. Like you could say, you know, the same ability to follow the sunset.
Right.
Man, I wish I would have come up with something better. Can also be used to follow herds of game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden, we now not only just know to follow the sunset if we want to follow the sunset, we also know we can use that same ability to follow game around. And now all of a sudden, our diet expands, that kind of thing. So as these different modules started cross-referencing themselves and got more and more connected, we were able to apply these different things to more and more situations and got more and more intelligent.
All right. So that's one sort of grand theory, which I love.
I do too.
Another one that we're going to talk about is, I think, super interesting because some of this stuff is so kind of rudimentary in it when you just sort of look at it from a macro view.
Mm-hmm.
But when you really stop to think about how important that ended up being, it's fascinating to me. And in this case, we're talking about the fact that one of the sort of side, and again, it's going back to bipedalism, one of the side effects of bipedalism is that we lost our ability with our feet to be able to like hang on to things like chimpanzees do. These boots were all of a sudden made for walking. and they weren't made for grabbing. And if they weren't made for grabbing, then you couldn't hang on to mama like a chimp could with hands and feet. So mama had to hang on to human baby, and mama can't hang on to human baby all the time because mama still has to get things done around the, you know, savannah. So what you have to do then is leave that baby somewhere and go do stuff, like go down to the river and do things. And if you leave a baby somewhere, what?
You go down to the river and do certain things.
Do things, you know.
Unmentionable things.
And if you leave that baby, and this is all leading to this statement, if you leave that baby somewhere, you want to be able to go back and find that baby. And it seems so rudimentary and basic, but that is a huge thing in the development of the early human brain, is simply to spatially map and remember, like, where I have left this child, it's important to go back and get that child. Mm-hmm. And I can do that.
Yeah. And then consequently to that, another adaptation seems to have arisen from the same problem, the problem of not being able to cling to the mother anymore. And then also the problem of the baby being otherwise helpless, way more helpless than a baby chimp, right? Mm-hmm. So they think that around the same time, babies' cries developed. Like, you don't hear other things necessarily crying like a human baby. And they don't think that babies cried like that until around this time because there was that problem. So even if a mom couldn't remember where she put her baby, she could listen out for the baby crying. And they also think around this time that an urge or desire to soothe the baby from its crying would have developed, and that it's possible, Chuck, and this makes so much awesome sense, that language actually developed out of what's called motherese, that kind of soothing baby talk that calms a baby that mothers know how to do just naturally. They think that it's possible that that is what formed the basis of language.
Yeah, and I'm going to go beyond that even, because what I noticed when I had a baby in the house was that even beyond the soothing thing, if you are holding your baby and you have to put your baby down to go wash the dishes or whatever, generally, and I think I speak for most parents, you don't just go set your baby down, go in the other room and do stuff. You're talking to that baby from the very beginning. And you're saying, all right, let's go over to our little place here. I'll be right back. I'm going to be right here in the other room. That baby doesn't know what you're talking about, obviously. But there just seems to be this evolutionary instinct to say things to it.
Right
out of the gate. It's really interesting.
It is interesting. And then wrapped up in this also, there's a better example than following the stupid sunset that I came up with.
I love sunsets.
But if you can now all of a sudden, like, remember where landmarks are and then wayfind your way back to, you know, a starting point, now you can start to use that to follow game further and further afield, and you're expanding your range and you can expand your diet. So that's a really good example of one thing kind of leading to another, and all of it being arising from environmental pressures brought on by changes to of us.
Yeah, I love it.
Me too.
This next one is kind of fits in a little bit with the plasticity, I think, the idea of the cognitive niche, which is, you know, typically figuring out like a solution to a problem. But this theory is that maybe intelligence evolved as a universal adaptation to all kinds of evolutionary pressures that we're bearing down. So, and Ed has a pretty great example. If you've got an island with a tree that has a certain fruit seed that's really beneficial for your body, but you can't crack into it, there's, you know, it would take a bird, you know, hundreds to thousands or millions of years to develop and evolve to have a beak that can crack that thing open. But if all of a sudden you know how to make a tool, you can just walk over and steal that thing from that dumb bird and just crack it open with the tool. So it's not filling, it's your brain at work, and in that case, it's filling a specific niche. But that's a tool that was also used to kill the animal or chop the wood.
Yeah, and that really supports what we were talking about a few minutes ago, that once evolution, once a brain is evolved to a certain amount of intellect, the brain can take care of the organism, and natural selection and genetics can kind of take a step back and not have to say, like, select for a thicker, hairier chest because we're living in a colder time now, because the brain can come up with a way to create a coat, right? So it just kind of takes over evolution from evolution by doing that. And that's that cognitive niche. And one of the consequences of it is that there seems to be, as things change in our environment, we figure out new ways to solve those. And then those solutions are inevitably going to create other problems or changes. So then we have to evolve even further intelligence to figure out how to solve these new problems. And you can actually see it still going on today, Chuck. Like, we've evolved a level of intelligence where we can extract petroleum from the earth. Mm-hmm. We can build machines that run on that petroleum, and we can develop science that figures out that burning that petroleum is really, really bad for the climate.
Yeah.
So now we've altered our ecosystem enough that we have to evolve intelligence enough to figure out how to get out of this new conundrum that we've created for ourselves based on our previous intellect. So intellect builds on intellect through environmental pressures that we often bring on ourselves. That seems like the case.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people seem to think of intelligence as only solving problems, but it also creates a lot as well. It's interesting.
Yeah, it really is.
I know we were going to skip this section entirely, but I think just for funsies, we should very quickly mention one. The idea is from someone called Terence McKenna, who Ed describes as a postmodern Timothy Leary type, one of these people that advocates for psychedelic drug use. And just very quickly, the idea is that the cavemen were tripping on mushrooms, and that's how intelligence evolved. And I just like mentioning it because I feel like there's almost nothing, no leap in history that some person hasn't said, like the Enlightenment or whatever, like, oh man, they were just tripping.
Right.
They were just super
stoned. They were on grass.
I just think it's pretty funny.
It is funny, but it does, I mean, like if you apply it exclusively to the upper Paleolithic revolution, where all of a sudden there's like art and jewelry and dancing
and
all that stuff, it's possible that it was shroom-based, at least in part, you know?
Yeah, you never know.
All right, so I say we take a break and we come back and get down to the nitty-gritty of how food might have brought intelligence along. How about that? Hey there, are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals. But you can drink water as clean as nature intended.
Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain, everybody. This rain is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants commonly found in groundwater.
Yep, Richard's Rainwater is naturally pure with no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing.
And you can enjoy the clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold-pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And we even have a special offer, don't we, Josh?
Yeah, text STUFF to 2512928887, and you'll get $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater. Sip the sky. All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on!
Hey Hey, everybody, if you're building a deck at work and you want to supercharge it, check out Canva Presentations. Work docs have been the same for too long, but Canva docs are different. They're visual. They grab readers' attention with images, charts, tables, and videos playable right in the doc. Plus, docs don't have to be just words on a page. You can make your docs pop with Canva docs.
That's right. And Canva Presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, HR, ops, marketing, and more, Canva Presentations can be the solution for you. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it.
Canva Presentations might be the most visually impressive presentations you'll ever use. Start with a stunning template, use it as a springboard for your design, adding images, graphics, charts, data visualizations, all from a massive media library. It's super easy to wow any audience with Canva Presentations.
So start designing today at canva.com, designed for work. That's canva.com.
You know, Chuck, the first cell phone was demonstrated all the way back in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated?
What's that?
Shared plans.
Interesting. You know, over 50 years later, you can save on one line now thanks to Visible. When you switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible, you can get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included.
Yeah, that's true. No hidden fees. Really? And you can save on wireless with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. It's 2024, so get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
By the way, Chuck, I have a theory real quick that the more you say or the more intelligent you are.
Oh, boy. I must be a smarty pants. You know, other more intelligent podcasts cut all that stuff out.
Yeah, I guess. Do they?
Yeah. I mean, what did I mispronounced in the Roe episode? I couldn't even substantive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's true. Other podcasts would not have left that in. But that's just
because... what kind of dummy leaves that in a podcast?
They're not as brave. We're courageous podcasters.
Okay, I'll buy that. This next theory I think is super cool because anytime you tie in not just food, but sort of an appreciation for a creature comfort, it really like turns me on and not, you know... Not in that kind of way.
In certain ways.
Intellectually turns me on. And in this case, we're talking about the fact that we used fire, obviously, and then started cooking food. Mm-hmm. And people that cooked food said, wow, this is really good. And this tastes a whole lot better than that raw meat we've been eating. Mm-hmm. This charred meat is delicious. And let's try and do more of this around here.
Yeah. And so that would have just them being responding to like a taste preference, and that's it. But it just so happened that that taste preference would have had a really big benefit and a big contribution to the development of intelligence, because if you cook meat, you unlock a bunch of nutrients and calories that are otherwise unavailable to you if you just eat it raw. So over time, the people who ate meat would have had more energy and more calories to contribute to a growing brain, which could have helped the process along, if not sped it up.
And if you consider the fact that we've definitely seen that taste and smell has responded to evolutionary pressures, mm-hmm. in that we at some point learned not to eat poop, and we learned not to eat rotten food and mm-hmm. stuff. And that's, you know, taste and smell. It can have the, you know, it looks like it can have the opposite effect too, where all of a sudden you have a preference for the good and that just happens to work out in your favor.
Yeah. And this is another example of one thing leading to another, where like, you know, mothers developed an awareness of landmarks and wayfinding, and then that led to being able to follow game, which expanded our diet, which led to us eating meat, which eventually led to applying controlled fire to that meat, which led to more calories and nutrients available, which led to bigger brain growth, which helped found the growth of intelligence in humans. Just one thing, one totally random, unconnected thing, or even connected, but seemingly unconnected, just creating us today. It's just so nutso to me. I love it.
Yeah, me too. And the fact that, like, think about this. Not only the preference for a charred meat, but the preference for a specific charred meat. Because, you know, different stuff tastes different. It's not like everything tastes like chicken. I know that's the joke, but all of a sudden Tuk-Tuk is out there and says, boy, that one thing that we killed yesterday, you guys, I don't know about you, but that was really, really delicious. Mm-hmm. And we know that that is, we saw that thing 3 days ago, about 50 miles away.
Right.
And everyone said, what's a mile? And he went, well, that doesn't matter right now. But the point, it was really far away. So all of a sudden, other things are introduced, like cooperation, not just wayfinding, but hey, let's all get together because this is like a 3-day journey. And this thing is really big that tastes so delicious. So it's going to take a few of us to bring this thing down,
right,
and to process this animal and get this meat ready for cooking. So it just introduces like a cascade. And this, and it could have all just come from, hey, that tastes really great.
Yeah. And so that you know, those, all that hunting and coordinating, all of that takes like a lot of intelligence. And not only does it take intelligence to coordinate, it takes intelligence to explain what you're talking about. And it takes intelligence to come up with that plan in the first place, you know? So all of those factors combining are just making humans more and more intelligent with every step. And again, it's not like it's just following this perfect linear progression.
Yeah.
It's just it's just kind of randomly. And the reason that we're intelligent today is because the attempts that didn't work out got selected out. The fat got trimmed along the way. Is it kind of a ruthless way to put it, but you know, it makes sense.
And that sort of ties into this other theory of smaller prey. Like when they were hunting large prey species, that, you know, they eventually they were hunting and tracking these large animals, and eventually they were driven to extinction. So humans had to start going after smaller things, or I guess hominins had to start going after smaller things. And the fossil record indicates this. It sort of worked in lockstep with the evolution of human intelligence. So all of a sudden, if you're hunting smaller things, you probably have to be a little bit smarter. You have to be a little bit more coordinated. You have to cooperate a little more. Mm-hmm. You have to maybe invent new tools. And like, obviously using a big thing to smash a large thing isn't the same thing as smashing a small thing. and just simply the fact that they had to do a lot more of it. You know, if you're eating a squirrel as your diet, you're eating a lot of squirrel every day. Whereas if you eat a woolly mammoth, that's your food for the month or whatever.
Exactly. And that's a really good example of what I was talking about earlier, that cognitive niche, where the more sophisticated we get, the more problems we actually generate for ourselves, the more challenges, the more intelligent we have to become.
That's right. And what about this last notion? And then I think this is kind of where it all comes together, right?
Yeah. So, you know, we have like a real urge and a desire to wrap everything up in a neat little package. And we just haven't reached that point yet with human intelligence. But if you step back and look at some of the theories and see how they all kind of fit together, it seems like most or all of them, with the exception of stoned ape probably, could be right. But they all have to work together and work with one another. Which is great, because that level of organization requires intelligence.
That's right. But the key to all of this, and I think we talked about the evolution of language on a whole show, right?
I think so, yeah.
We still don't quite know exactly how that evolved, but we have some ideas, like we talked about with the, what did you call it, motherants? No.
Motherese.
Motherese. But all of this became possible because of language. All of this, like you were saying, all of this coordination, all this cooperation, anything that would eventually lead to writing down human history, all of that had to have language. So it seems that all of these sort of theories coalescing around the beginnings of language and eventually the written word is like the key to it all.
Yeah, totally. And one of the other things, because we are so aware that we're intellectually superior, not only to all the other animals, or at the very least, we're intellectually different from the other smart ones. We tend to think of ourselves as the most intellectually evolved or the most successful humans ever. And that's absolutely not the case. I think Homo erectus was around for 1.5 million years, and modern humans have only been around for about 300,000 years. So we're definitely not necessarily the pinnacle of evolution, just in the amount of time and success we've had so far. But also, we have a tendency to think like we're the top and there's nothing coming. And that's not necessarily true either. Like if you look at that acceleration in technology, like some of our ancestors used the same tool for 1.5 million years without innovating upon it. They just made that same tool over and over and over again. And then somebody came along who was born and figured out a way to make it better, and that kicked off more and more technology. And you can see it's picking up faster and faster. But the fact that evolution has jumped from the external world for us to our brains and in turn to our culture, you can make a really good case that we're not necessarily going to physically evolve any longer. We're going to mentally evolve. So it's not certain what humanity is going to look like in the future, but it's probably going to happen. The changes are going to happen a lot faster soon than they have been before.
And we'll all just end up brains in jars, right?
Probably. Or uploaded.
That's right. Oh, boy.
Good luck with that, everybody.
That had a very so long suckers ring to it.
You got anything else?
I got nothing else. I love these types of episodes. Me this is good stuff.
Me too. Since Chuck and I agreed we'd love this episode, it's time for listener mail.
So this is another Appalachian Trail, probably the last one I'll read because Sophie here, a.k.a. Tough Cookie,
nice,
which was Sophie's trail name, is just a lovely human, and we had a nice back and forth. Sophie and Sophie's sister did a Nobo through hike in 2017 and just had some kind of fun things to point out. One of the general rules of trail names is someone else has to give it to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of like if you're a pilot in the military, you're like a Maverick and Goose. I think people think they name themselves cool names, but my brother-in-law was like, no, you get a name, and it's usually not something super cool like Maverick.
Yeah, if you name yourself, I'm sure that people are going to be way harder on you in the name they actually select for you.
Yeah, I don't even know if you're allowed to. I'm not sure. Sophie says that my sister and I cheated a little bit because we gave names to each other a few days in. I don't think that's cheating. You're still naming someone else.
Sure, that's called getting ahead of the curve.
We did have some unofficial trail names, though, that other people would refer to the pair of us as. My favorite was a 60-year-old Kentucky hiker from Maine who told us he referred to us as the Kentucky Wonders, which is pretty fun. And one thing I realized after reading all these AT emails is that it's really kind of fun. Like, people get together and, like, they start off alone, and all of a sudden there's a group of, like, 12 people hiking together for weeks at a time.
That is the very reason why I will never hike the AT. That sounds like a nightmare to me.
You would be the loner hiker.
Totally. They'd be like, don't turn your back on that one.
I think your trail name might be Ted Bundy.
That's right.
The trail through West Virginia is actually less than 4 miles. And I heard this from other people, too. Not 18, so I think we screwed that up. It's an amazing feeling to go through so quickly after psychologically after completing Virginia, which is 500 miles and a quarter of the whole entire trail. And there is a 4-state challenge that some hikers will attempt to do, a 45-mile day to go through the end of Virginia, West Virginia, Maryland, and into Pennsylvania in 24 hours.
That's a lot.
Her family hosts a trail magic spot because they live near the trail in Tennessee. So they will go out on the weekends and they pack up a bunch of hiker food and they grill burgers and stuff or make pancakes and just feed people on the trail.
Man, that is so nice.
And then we'll go back home. I think you could be down with that part, right?
Sure. I'd eat a free hamburger.
You're like, can I take it to go?
I'd be like, why? Right. I'd be like, why is there mustard on here but not ketchup?
And then finally, during the hike, we would treat ourselves to podcasts for a couple hours. when hiking was getting monotonous and wanted to get out of our heads some. And your voices were a frequent companion. Listening to stuff you should know selects these days, often had the weird sensation of remembering exactly where I was hiking in the woods when I listened to that episode in 2017. Come to Kentucky sometime, check out the bourbon distilleries and the Red River Gorge, and do a show here. Lexington, I know you'd probably rather go to Louisville or Cincinnati, but Lexington is definitely worth a visit. And Sophie sent along a bunch of cool pictures of Sophie and her sister before and after, and it's just looked like a really great time.
That's awesome. Thanks a lot for that email, Sophie. That was a great one. And agreed, Chuck, that one had to be read for sure.
Just stay away from Josh if you see him in the woods.
No, I'm harmless. I just don't want to be spoken to, that's all. I want to be left alone. It's too awkward otherwise.
You could just hike with big, giant, like 1970s headphones as if you're listening to something.
That's right. With my head down, sunglasses on, and a bag over my head.
I love it.
If you want to be like Sophie and get in touch with us, you can send us an email. Send it off
Stuff
to
You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you thirsty? Well, Richard's rainwater is caught clean before it even hits the ground. Rain is naturally pure, so there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. Richard's rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of still rainwater or the cold pressured bubbles of sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And for a coupon, text STUFF to 251-292-8887 and receive $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
In Puerto Rico, there's adventure around every corner and natural treasures waiting to be explored, like El Yunque, the only tropical rainforest in the U.S. Get swept away by natural beauty and come away with unique stories that could only be experienced in Puerto Rico and that remind you why you travel in the first place. Visits end, but stories last forever. You don't become a part of the island, it becomes a part of you. No passports required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.